welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Monday, March 18th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. We'll start with today's weather. Today will be mostly sunny, with a high of 45 degrees. Tonight will be mainly clear, with a low of 31 degrees. Tuesday will be sunny and breezy in the evening, with a high of 61 degrees. And now we turn to local and state news. In news from the Sioux City Council, Lamb Arts faces lease termination. Old Webster School in poor condition. Dolly A. Butch reports from Sioux City. The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to terminate Lamb Arts Regional Theater's lease of the former Webster School for failing to keep the building in a reasonably safe and serviceable condition. The Performing Arts Group has been leasing the two-story brick building at 417 Market Street from the city since April 20, 2015. On February 21, 2023, the city notified Lamb that holding assemblies or classes in the building was prohibited due to the life safety concerns. A draft of the termination notice addressed to Lamb founders Russell and Diane Woolley and signed by city manager Bob Padmore stated that the city did a number of inspections on the building and found that the building was not being maintained in a reasonably safe and serviceable condition. You were given several months to resolve these issues, including repair of the boiler system. Additional inspections in January and February showed that there was little to no resolution to the issues, and you were placed on notice that due to the condition of the building, you were prohibited from holding any assemblies or classes in the building, the notice stated. This directive prevents you from utilizing the building for the stated use under the lease, a regional performing arts theater. Although the lease requires only a 10-day advance written notice of termination, city staff is recommending the council give Lamb a 30-day notice, given the large amount of personal property in the building. Last month, Lamb announced a partnership with Morningside University to temporarily bring Lamb Theater productions to the Sioux City College's Klinger-Neal Theater at 3700 Peters Avenue. Lamb school classes will also transition to Morningside's campus, according to a statement issued by Lamb. Russell Woolley, who served as Lamb's managing artistic director, said the decision to move all activities to Morningside University was a direct result of the deteriorating condition of their current building, a former school on the west side. We've been producing quality, live, theatrical entertainment in Siouxland for 44 years. The old Webster School at 417 Market Street has served us well for 38 of those years, but that building is no longer sustainable as a venue for our productions and Lamb School classes, he said in the statement. Woolley said moving Lamb Theater to Morningside University will allow Lamb to keep producing theater while it continues to pursue options for a transition to a completely new home. Lamb purchased the former Sioux City Auditorium at 625 Douglas Street in 2017, with plans to renovate it into a regional theater. The auditorium, which was built in 1909, has been red-tagged since June 2022. The roof on the old auditorium began leaking in the fall of 2022 and gradually collapsed on the brick structure's west side. In January, Diana Woolley told the Journal, "Things will start happening very soon with the project. We're in kind of a funny spot. We're looking at everything, looking at all of our options right now. We're working daily on this," she said. "We have a developer from Omaha that we're working with. We've got a campaign guru that's helping us with funding and all that sort of thing. We've got some incredibly beautiful plans drawn up." Woolley made the comments after Benson Building developer Steve Nelson asked the council in late January to take action on the auditorium, even if it means tearing down the historic building, which is across the street from his property. "At some point, if that roof continues to collapse, there's a chance that building could fall, or a portion of it, or a couple of the walls," Nelson said. The city recently made a formal request to the Woolleys to provide a report on the old auditorium's structural condition. In October 2017, the city council approved a $350,000 economic development loan to Lamb Arts to purchase the building. It's a significant issue, so we are waiting to hear back from them on that. We should see some information on that very soon, Daugherty told the Journal after Nelson raised concerns to the council. It's their building. We have an agreement and a loan, but we also make sure that buildings are safe. Symphony performs music of Led Zeppelin with cover band, but Bruce R. Miller reports, when you learn an orchestra is going to play the music of a classic rock group, you think you're going to hear the music a different way. Such wasn't the case with Winborn's music of Led Zeppelin Saturday night. The collaboration with the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra was little more than a cover band backed by the orchestra. The four Winborn members often turned it up to 11, and in many instances overpowered the more than 50 musicians behind them. When the band did simmer down, it was possible to appreciate the notes that made the British band a game changer. In All My Love, the strings got a chance to step forward and show how good the writing was. Several other times, the flutes got a moment. Other songs, however, didn't appear to be orchestrated for this kind of presentation. Winborn lead singer Randy Jackson had ample opportunity to ply his plant roots, but wasn't afforded much time without the other three members of the band. Guitarist Steve Zukowski, who was superb, got several key showcases. Drummer Powell Randolph earned a solo spot that was long enough to give the others a significant break. For Dancin' Days, conductor Ryan Haskins turned the baton over to a contest winner. On several songs, audience members gave Jackson a run for his volume. The evening's goal, though, was never quite clear. Jackson indicated what albums the various songs were from, but didn't provide much in terms of history or details about the song's inspirations. When Robert Plant was in Sioux City in 1990, he offered a master class in the compositions of Led. Lighting frequently helped set the mood. Saturday, those extras weren't present. While Jackson was able to make it through those very high notes, ending strongly on several songs, he often lost some of the words in the presentation. His thank you was great, and his since I've been loving you was appropriately blues. Others, however, could have been swapped out with different hits. By the time Stairway to Heaven rolled around, it was clear this wasn't a retrospective, just an appreciation. On that note, it was fine. But with a stage full of extremely talented musicians, it could have been so much more. Sensational Soul Food. Inspired by backyard barbecues, Quincy Lewis creates award-winning ribs, down-home faves. Earl Horlick reports from Sioux City. Food is good for the soul, especially when it is expertly smoked and covered in a sweet and savory barbecue sauce for optimal melt-in-your-mouth deliciousness. That has been the winning recipe at the Soul Food Saturday and Sunday events held by Quincy Lewis by his distinctively down-home rib shack-looking Lewis Brothers barbecue food truck. The Omaha native has the trophies to back up his barbecue bravado. A perennial participant at Camp High Hope's Rib Fest, Lewis Brothers Barbecue always excels in the rib and people's choice categories. Their thick and rich barbecue sauce has even gotten a shout-out by Tamron Hall on her nationally syndicated daytime TV talk show. Yet it is the happy faces of customers that keep Lewis going. On a windy Saturday afternoon, there is already a line starting inside of the parking lot at the Family Dollar at 18th and Pierce Streets a few minutes after he puts up an open for business sign. As soon as people see our truck, they'll stop on over, Lewis explained. I know of one lady in particular who will drive all over town looking for us. Once she finds us, the lady will say, I need my Lewis Brothers rack of ribs, she continued. A lot of people may do ribs. We do ribs our own way. Indeed, many of the Lewis Brothers barbecue recipes come straight from his family. I'm from a family with 8 kids, Lewis explained. We never had much money, but we sure ate well. A typical summertime barbecue dinner was actually the inspiration for the Lewis Brothers Soul Food Weekend menu. In addition to ribs, you can get smoked chicken, baked chicken, collard greens, cornbread dressing, as well as something Lewis recently added to the lineup, we make pulled pork nachos, which is our Lewis Brothers pulled pork, drenched in sauce and a gooey cheese, served over a bed of nachos, he said with a smile. They are so good. Plus, many of the meals will be made personally by Lewis or a member of his large family, including son Kamari and daughter Kiana. Yes, me and all of my siblings have the initial QL, just like our dad, Kiana Lewis said. Also like dad, the Lewis kids are learning the art and science behind smoked meats. I personally know all of dad's recipes, and I do make them at home, Kiana Lewis said with a shrug. Still, the food always tastes better when he does it. Dad has the magic touch. More likely, the elder Lewis has experience on his side. A self-taught entrepreneur, Lewis said his business grew by word of mouth. Starting off small nearly 5 years ago, the mobile restaurant has seen steady growth. When they aren't pulling up into a business's parking lot, Lewis Brothers Barbecue caters everything from charitable events to small parties to large corporate gigs. Yet it is at the more neighborhood-oriented soul food weekend events where Lewis really shines. Running a food truck is hard work, he explained. Sometimes my day starts at 4 a.m. and won't end until late that night. Lewis readily admits the profession isn't for everybody. There are plenty of used food trucks with price tags on them, he said. That's because people lose their passion and they are no longer motivated by what they're doing. This will never happen to Lewis, he said. Nah, I believe in my product too much, and the smile on the faces of my returning customers is all of the proof I need. Featured prominently around the Lewis Brothers Barbecue food truck is the catchphrase, "Come get you some." As long as people want delicious barbecue, Lewis said, they can get some from us. And now we turn to national and world news stories. From the Middle East, Netanyahu rips speech. Schumer calls for elections in Israel as Gaza offensive drags on. From Tel Aviv, Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu railed Sunday against growing criticism from top ally the United States against his leadership amid the devastating war with Hamas, describing calls for a new election as wholly inappropriate. In recent days, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish official in the country and a strong Israel supporter, called on Israel to hold a new election, saying Netanyahu had lost his way. President Joe Biden expressed support for Schumer's good speech and earlier accused Netanyahu of hurting Israel because of the huge civilian death toll in Gaza. Netanyahu told Fox News that Israel never would have called for a new U.S. election after the September 11th attacks in 2001 and denounced Schumer's comments as inappropriate. "We're not a banana republic," he said. "The people of Israel will choose when they will have elections and who they'll elect, and it's not something that will be foisted on us." When asked by CNN whether he would commit to a new election after the war ends, Netanyahu said that, "I think that's something for the Israeli public to decide." The U.S., which has provided key military and diplomatic support to Israel, also has expressed concerns about a planned Israeli assault on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where about 1.4 million displaced Palestinians are sheltering. The spokesman for the National Security Council, John Kirby, told Fox the U.S. still hasn't seen an Israeli plan for Rafah. The U.S. supports a new round of talks aimed at securing a ceasefire in exchange for the return of Israeli hostages taken in Hamas's October 7th attack. The Israeli delegation to those talks was expected to leave for Qatar after Sunday evening meetings of the Security Cabinet and War Cabinet, which will give directions for negotiations. Despite the talks, Netanyahu made it clear he would not back down from the fighting that has killed more than 31,000 Palestinians, according to local health officials. More than 5 months have passed since Hamas's attack on southern Israel killed 1,200 people and left another 250 hostage. Earlier Sunday, Netanyahu said that calls for an election now, which polls show he would lose badly, would force Israel to stop fighting and paralyze the country for 6 months. Netanyahu also reiterated his determination to attack Hamas in Rafah and said that his government approved military plans for such an operation. "We will operate in Rafah. This will take several weeks, and it will happen," he said. "The operation is supposed to include the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of civilians, but it is not clear how Israel will do that." Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi reiterated his warning that an Israeli ground offensive in Rafah would have grave repercussions on the whole region. In Russian elections, Putin easily wins another term. He says he agreed to let Navalny out of prison ahead of vote. Russian President Vladimir Putin basked in a victory early Monday that was never in doubt, as partial election results showed him easily securing a fifth term after facing only token challengers and harshly suppressing opposition voices. With little margin for protest, Russians crowded outside polling stations at noon Sunday, on the last day of the election, apparently heeding an opposition call to express their displeasure with Putin. Still, the impending landslide underlined that Russian leader would accept nothing less than full control of the country's political system, as he extends his nearly quarter-century rule for 6 more years. Putin hailed the early results as an indication of trust and hope in him, while critics saw them as another reflection of the preordained nature of the election. "Of course, we have lots of tasks ahead, but I want to make it clear for everyone, when we were consolidated, no one has ever managed to frighten us, to suppress our will and our self-conscience. They failed in the past and they will fail in the future," Putin said at a meeting with volunteers after polls closed. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter, "The polls have closed in Russia following the illegal holding of elections on Ukrainian territory, a lack of choice for voters, and no independent OSCE monitoring. This is not what free and fair elections look like. Any public criticism of Putin or his war in Ukraine has been stifled. Independent media have been crippled. His fierce political foe, Alexei Navalny, died in an Arctic prison last month, and other critics are either in jail or in exile. Beyond the fact that voters had virtually no choice, independent monitoring of the election was extremely limited. According to Russia's Central Election Commission, Putin had some 87% of the vote, with about 90% of precincts counted. In that tightly controlled environment, Navalny's associates urged those unhappy with Putin or the war in Ukraine to go to the polls at noon on Sunday, and lines outside a number of polling stations both inside Russia and at its embassies around the world appeared to swell at that time. Among those heeding the call was Yulia Navalnaya, Navalny's widow, who joined a long line in Berlin as some in the crowd applauded and chanted her name. She spent more than 5 hours in the line and told reporters after casting her vote that she wrote her late husband's name on the ballot. Asked whether she had a message for Putin, Navalnaya replied, "Please stop asking for messages from me or from somebody for Mr. Putin. There could be no negotiations and nothing with Mr. Putin because he's a killer. He's a gangster." Usually, Putin referenced Navalny by name for the first time. Unusually, Putin referenced Navalny by name for the first time in years at the news conference, and he said he was informed of an idea to release the opposition leader from prison, days before his death. Putin said that he agreed to the idea on condition that Navalny didn't return to Russia. EU announces $8 billion in financial aid for Egypt. From Cairo. The European Union on Sunday announced an $8 billion aid package for cash-strapped Egypt, as concerns mount that economic pressure and conflicts in neighboring countries could drive more migrants to European shores. The deal, which drew criticism from rights groups over Egypt's human rights record, was signed Sunday afternoon in Cairo by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. The ceremony was attended by leaders of Belgium, Italy, Austria, Cyprus, and Greece. "Your visit today represented a very important milestone in the relations between Egypt and the European Union," el-Sisi told visiting European leaders. He said the deal achieved a paradigm shift in our partnership. The aid package includes both grants and loans over the next 3 years for the Arab world's most populous country, according to the EU's mission in Cairo. Most of the money, $5.4 billion, is macro financial assistance, according to a document from the EU mission in Egypt. The mission said the two sides have promoted their cooperation to the level of a strategic and comprehensive partnership, paving the way for expanding Egypt-EU cooperation in various economic and non-economic areas. "The European Union recognizes Egypt as a reliable partner and its unique and vital geostrategic role as a pillar of security, moderation, and peace in the Mediterranean, Near East, and African region," a joint statement said after the summit. Charges announced in deaths, carjackings, from Levittown, Pennsylvania. A man faces murder charges in Pennsylvania and carjacking and weapons charges in New Jersey after allegedly killing three family members, carjacking vehicles in both states, and evading law enforcement for hours as police mobilized in two states, authorities said Sunday. Andre Gordon Jr., 26, is charged in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, with three counts of first and second degree murder, aggravated assault, robbery, and other charges, according to court documents. In New Jersey, Gordon is charged with first-degree carjacking and weapons offenses, New Jersey Attorney General Matthew J. Platkin said in a statement Sunday. "The string of violent acts is the latest in a horrific litany of illustrations of how illegal guns and assault rifles can empower one aggrieved and disturbed actor," Platkin said. Ohio governor declares state of emergency, from Columbus, Ohio. Ohio's governor declared a state of emergency in 11 counties across central Ohio struck by severe weather last week. Governor Mike DeWine also activated the Ohio National Guard to help officials in Logan County, where three deaths were confirmed, with the cleanup of storm debris on public property. DeWine announced the emergency declaration Sunday. The declaration also covers Auglaize, Crawford, Dark, Delaware, Hancock, Licking, Mercer, Miami, Richland, and Union counties. Officer killed. A suspect in the shooting death of a New Mexico police officer, 33-year-old Jeremy Smith of Marion, South Carolina, was captured Sunday by law enforcement officers in the Albuquerque area based on a tip from a gas station clerk, authorities said Sunday at a news conference. Fatal crash. A traffic crash in southern Afghanistan left at least 21 people dead and 38 others injured, according to a provincial traffic department. The crash occurred on Sunday morning in Helmand Province when a motorbike crashed into a passenger bus, which then hit a fuel tanker on the opposite side of the road, officials said. Ship attack. A suspected attack by Yemen's Houthi rebels saw an explosive detonate near a ship early Sunday in the Gulf of Aden, potentially marking their latest assault on shipping through the crucial waterway leading to the Red Sea. No damage was reported. Airstrikes. Israeli airstrikes hit several sites in southern Syria early Sunday, wounding a soldier, Syrian state media reported. State news agency Sana'a citing an unnamed military official, said air defenses shot down some of the missiles, which came from the direction of the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Volcano erupts. Lava from a volcanic eruption in Iceland flowed Sunday toward defenses around the town of Grindavík, which have so far held the molten rock back from the evacuated community. Scientists said the eruption would probably peter out within hours. And finally, Moldova. A drone strike at a military installation in Moldova's breakaway Republic of Transnistria on Sunday destroyed a helicopter and ignited a fire, authorities in the pro-Russia region said. The area's pro-Russian officials blamed the strike on Ukraine. And now, before we turn to sports at the halfway mark, we'll get some advice from Ask Amy, from Amy Dickinson. Estrangement extends through generations. Dear Amy, my boyfriend of 10 years, with a few breaks, does not have a close relationship with his parents and really no relationship at all with his two siblings. Little things have happened through the years that have upset people, and no one ever communicates or makes up with each other. He also doesn't have good relationships with his young adult daughters. They seem to have chosen their mom over him. He does try to reach out, but with little response from them. I have gotten really frustrated with how everyone acts and the horrible communication and how badly they treat him, so I completely stay out of it. I say nothing to any of them because I barely know them anyway. Is that the right thing to do? Signed, Sad Woman in Arizona. Dear Sad, you have chosen to be with someone who does not have a track record of healthy relationships with others. It sounds as if his family system is dysfunctional, and while this could be the reason for his behavior, he doesn't seem motivated to do things differently. After 10 years with him, you might have had opportunities to affect this dynamic to some degree, but you don't seem eager to exert yourself either. I suggest that he concentrate on trying to repair the relationship with his children. You can be helpful here by working on developing a braver and more functional communication style, by supporting his efforts, and by encouraging him to keep trying with an open, loving attitude. If these daughters have aligned with their mother, they might have been lied to, and their own spirits and relationships poisoned. He should patiently try to rewrite the faulty narrative with the hopes of creating a new storyline with this generation. I appreciate the work of Cornell University researcher Carl Pillemer, PhD, whose book Fault Lines, Fractured Families and How to Mend Them, offers scholarship illustrating this common phenomenon, as well as compassionate and practical advice for how to attempt reconciliation. Dear Amy, my fiancé and I are getting married this summer. My fiancé, William, is in his mid-30s. He has one brother, Sam, who is 25. William has asked 5 friends to be groomsmen at the wedding. He really wanted to have men with him who have been extremely important in his life. He did not ask Sam to be in the wedding because he is significantly younger. Sam did not take it well. He has more or less stopped communicating with William, and when William asked him why, Sam told him that his feelings are very hurt and that he doesn't even want to attend the wedding now. Your thoughts? Signed, Engaged and Worried. Dear Engaged, your fiancé has one brother. He chose a handful of men to be groomsmen who have been extremely important in his life. Sam might not be the primary male connection in William's life due to the 10-year age difference, but I guarantee that the elder brother is the primary male connection for the younger brother. This exclusion hurts. He's been honest about how hurt he is, and I think that your fiancé should apologize and offer him a place in the wedding. Once again, you are listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, March 18th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's sports stories. And now, as we head into March Madness, here are these college basketball stories from the men's NCAA tournament preview. UConn, Purdue, Houston, UNC receive top seeding. Eddie Pels reports. Even before the brackets came out Sunday, March Madness was a muddled mess. About the closest thing to a sure thing, UConn. The defending championship Huskies earned the top seed in the NCAA tournament, joined by Houston, Purdue, and North Carolina as number one seeds in a bracket that started going haywire even before the pairings were announced Sunday evening. Of those top teams, only UConn heads into the tournament coming off a win. The others lost in their conference tournaments, yet those were hardly the only surprises over the final weekend of hoops before the sport's main event hits center stage. Unexpected titles placed teams like Oregon, North Carolina State, and even Duquesne, none of whom were projected to make the tournament, into the field of 68 via the automatic bid that goes to conference champions. The teams they beat gobbled up a handful of the 34 at-large bids, thus shrinking the number of spots available to teams on the so-called bubble. "It was one of the most difficult that I've been involved in," Charles McClelland, the chairman of the selection committee, said of the process that had everyone up until 2:30 a.m. the night before. "And I talked to some of the staff that's been in that room for the last 20 years, and they said this is probably the most difficult selection process that they've been a part of. It showed in a bracket that had its share of head scratchers. Two of the last four teams in, Boise State and Colorado State, weren't even considered on the bubble by most bracketologists. A little surprised, to be honest," Boise State coach Leon Rice said of his team's number 10 seed. Some of the teams left out, St. John's and Oklahoma, were thought to be safely in as late as Saturday. St. John's decided not to even play in the NIT. "How is St. John's so far off the cut line?" said UConn coach Dan Hurley, who was surprised only three Big East teams made it. Florida Atlantic and Texas A&M were considered bubble teams, but ended up with 8 and 9 seeds, respectively. All of this could be fodder for the growing conversation about expanding the bracket to 76, maybe 80 teams. Under that scenario, bubble teams like Pittsburgh, Seton Hall, and even Indiana State would almost certainly be in. The tournament starts Tuesday with two first four games, including a matchup between Virginia and Colorado State. The 32 first-round games take place Thursday and Friday. The Final Four is set for April 6 to 8 in Glendale, Arizona. UConn, which opens Friday against Stetson, is the favorite according to FanDuel Sportsbook, and is trying to become the first repeat champion since Florida in 2006 and 07. The Huskies, who are at 31-3, are on a seven-game win streak and are tied with James Madison for most wins in the nation. For all its excellence this season, UConn ended up in an East region with two of last year's Final Four teams, San Diego State and Florida Atlantic, along with Iowa State, which is coming off a 69-41 win over Houston and was thought for a minute to be top seed material. "If we're able to get to our identity, and then we play harder than you, we keep ourselves from being vulnerable that way," Hurley said. Both the SEC and Big 12 placed 8 teams in the field, while the Big 10 and Mountain West each had 6. Speaking of pride, Michigan State extended its nation-leading streak to 26 straight years in the tournament. The 9th-seeded Spartans will play Mississippi State on Thursday, the same day number 5-seed Gonzaga plays number 12 McNeese. In February, the Zags were considered a bubble team, but a stretch of 9 wins in 10 games changed that, and coach Mark Few's team made the field for the 25th consecutive year. Injury-riddled Kansas comes in as a 4-seed, set to play Samford after two of its best players, Hunter Dickinson and Kevin McCuller Jr., sat out the Jayhawks' 20-point loss in their Big 12 tournament opener. Florida is a 7-seed, and will play the winner of the Boise State-Colorado play-in game. but the Gators suffered a big blow when big man Micah Hadlogden broke his leg early in the SEC title game. The Ivy League is sending Yale, a 13 seed that needed a furious late comeback and a buzzer-beating basket against Brown, to win the title and set up a game Friday against number 4 Auburn. And St. Peter's is back in the tournament 2 years after making an unlikely run to the Elite Eight as a number 15. This year, the Peacocks are 15 seeds again, opening against Tennessee in the Midwest. Should Tennessee advance, Coach Rick Barnes could face his old school number 7 Texas, which opens against the Virginia-Colorado State winner. Meanwhile, Duquesne, the surprise winner of the Atlantic 10, is back in the tournament for the first time since 1977. A game against number 6, Brigham Young University, awaits. And in the women's NCAA tournament preview, undefeated South Carolina earns top seed. Caitlin Clark, Iowa, also earned number 1 seed. Dawn Staley and South Carolina could see some familiar faces on their path to trying to finish off an undefeated season. The Gamecocks, who are the number 1 overall seed in the women's NCAA tournament, are looking to become the 10th women's basketball team to go unbeaten for an entire season. They had a chance last season before falling just short against Caitlin Clark in Iowa in the Final Four. The Hawkeyes received the number 1 seed in the Albany Regional. The two teams wouldn't potentially face off until the national championship game this time. Iowa is a 1 seed for the first time since 1992. USC and star freshman Juju Watkins earned the Trojans' first number 1 seed since 1986 as the top choice in a Portland Regional. Texas earned the 4th number 1 seed, its first since 2004, and will play Drexel in the other Portland Regional opener. There was debate whether Texas or Stanford could get the 4th number 1 seed. "To say we talked about it more than once was an understatement," said NCAA Selection Committee Chair Lisa Peterson. "What it came down to was Texas had to play 3 tournament teams to get to the Big 12 championship." South Carolina coach Dawn Staley's squad has been challenged a few times this year, including needing a buzzer-beating 3-pointer from Camilla Cardoso to win the semifinals of the SEC tournament over Tennessee, but has always pulled through. The Gamecocks, who are a number 1 seed for the 4th consecutive year, will play the winner of Sacred Heart and Presbyterian in the first round of the tournament. "I always feel good to be the number 1 overall seed and to be undefeated," Staley said. "I'm excited because we get a chance to know what our path is to win the national championship, and all great teams, a lot of familiar faces that are in our region. But we have to take it one game at a time, and that's what we'll do on Friday." Cardoso will miss the opening game after getting ejected for fighting in the SEC title game. The Gamecocks would have her back for a potential second-round matchup against either North Carolina or Michigan State. South Carolina beat the Tar Heels earlier in the season. "Fortunately for us, it's someone we played without for 4 games this season," Staley said. "We know we're a better basketball team when Camilla Cardoso is in the lineup." Joining the Gamecocks in the Albany region are number 2 seed Notre Dame, 3rd seeded Oregon State, and 4th seeded Indiana. And now these stories from the NBA. Irving's running left-hander at buzzer lifts Mavs over Nuggets. From Dallas. "A floater, a runner, a hook shot, call it whatever. Maybe Kyrie Irving would settle for a crucial game winner." The Dallas star hit a running left-handed shot at the buzzer, capping a wild final 26 seconds and giving the Mavericks a 107-105 victory over the Denver Nuggets on Sunday. Luka Doncic scored 37 points and Irving had 24 as the up-and-down Mavericks beat the defending champs for their fifth win in six games, answering a 1-5 stretch that followed a seven-game winning streak, Dallas's longest of the season. The Mavs pulled even with Phoenix as part of a virtual three-way tie with Sacramento for the sixth and final guaranteed playoff spot in the Western Conference. "In Kyrie we trust," said rookie center Derek Lively II, who had 14 points. "Whenever we see him get the ball, sit back and watch it happen." The Nuggets had a five-game road win streak stopped. They had won all five by double digits, a first in franchise history. Bucks 140, Suns 129. Damian Lillard had 31 points and 16 assists, and Bobby Portis added 31 points and 10 rebounds to lead Milwaukee over visiting Phoenix, which got 28 points from Bradley Beal. The Bucks hit 24 three-pointers, including an NBA record-tying 18 in the first half. Celtics 130, Wizards 104. Sam Hauser had career highs of 30 points and 10 threes to help Boston beat host Washington. Jason Tatum scored 30 points with 6 threes as the Celtics hit 24 shots from beyond the arc in a game in which they never trailed despite missing 3 starters. Spurs 122, Nets 115 in overtime. Victor Wembanyama had 33 points and 16 rebounds as host San Antonio overcame 31 points by Cam Thomas to beat Brooklyn and snap a 3-game skid. Wembanyama added 7 assists and 7 blocks. Heat 104, Pistons 101. Bam Adebayo made a 3-pointer at the buzzer to lift Miami over host Detroit. Cade Cunningham missed a 3-point shot for the Pistons with 9 seconds left. Duncan Robinson led the Heat with a season-high 30 points. Magic 111, Raptors 96. Paolo Banchero scored 29 points, and Orlando pulled away from visiting Toronto, handing the Raptors their 7th straight loss. The Magic are 8-2 in their past 10 games. Hawks 110, Clippers 93. DeJounte Murray scored 21 points, DeAndre Hunter added 20, and Atlanta beat Los Angeles on the road to snap a 3-game losing streak. Murray had 5 three-pointers, making a career-high 5th straight game he has made at least 4 from beyond the arc. In other NBA news, Warriors-Lakers game has lengthy ending. From Los Angeles, Steve Kerr has been part of plenty of exciting finishes between the Golden State Warriors and the Los Angeles Lakers. On Saturday night, the teams played a game that simply wouldn't finish. The final 2 minutes, 7 seconds of the Warriors' 128-121 victory over the Lakers took about 22 minutes to play, bogged down due to a pair of lengthy replay reviews, one that overturned an apparent 3-pointer by LeBron James, and then a malfunctioning shot clock. It seems like a few times a year you get clock issues. That's as extreme as I've been a part of, where even the backup unit doesn't work, Kerr said. The last 2 minutes, everyone is looking at each other about what to do. The craziness began when James hit a 3-pointer from the corner to pull the Lakers within 124-120. On the ensuing trip down the floor, Stephen Curry missed a 3, and there was a battle for the ball as it went out of bounds with 1 minute and 50 seconds left. Officials awarded the ball to Golden State, but the Lakers challenged who touched it last. At the same time, the replay center was reviewing James's shot. The Lakers won the challenge, but James's 3 was nullified. Bucks. Milwaukee center Giannis Antetokounmpo missed Sunday's game against the Phoenix Suns because of left hamstring soreness. Antetokounmpo is averaging 30.8 points, 11.2 rebounds, and 6.4 assists per game this season. Forward Chris Middleton returned to the starting lineup after missing the past 16 games with a sprained left ankle. And the NBA stat of the day, 30. C.J. McCollum broke out of a slump with 30 points to lead New Orleans over Portland on Saturday. He had not scored more than 20 points in his past 14 games and had not scored more than 14 in 5 of those games. And now these stories from the NHL. Eichel lifts Golden Knights over Devils. From Las Vegas, Jack Eichel scored his 21st goal of the season, and the Vegas Golden Knights defeated the New Jersey Devils 3-1 on Sunday. After the Devils took a 1-0 lead 38 seconds into the third period, the Golden Knights scored the next two goals, with Eichel's being the go-ahead. Maneuvering his way through the neutral zone and finding open ice at the top of the slot, Eichel finally beat New Jersey goalie Jake Allen with his 7th shot of the game, to the delight of an announced sold-out crowd of 18,234. "We stuck with it. It was a big win for us. We needed it," Eichel said. William Carrier and William Karlsson also scored for Vegas. Goalie Logan Thompson made 20 saves. Rangers 5, Islanders 2. Johnny Brodzinski scored the go-ahead goal in the second period, and the New York Rangers beat their in-state rival at Madison Square Garden. Igor Shesterkin had 25 saves for the Rangers, who have won 5 of 6. Bo Horvat scored twice for the Islanders, who have lost 4 in a row. Penguins 6, Red Wings 3. With his 583rd goal, Sidney Crosby matched Wayne Gretzky for the 7th most goals with a single franchise in NHL history, and Pittsburgh defeated visiting Detroit. Blackhawks 5, Sharks 2. Ryan Donato, Kevin Korchinski, and Joey Anderson scored during a 1:23 span in the third period, and Chicago rallied past visiting San Jose for its 4th win in 6 games. Jets 6, Blue Jackets 1. Tyler Toffoli had 2 goals and added an assist. Connor Hellebuyck stopped 30 shots, and Winnipeg earned a victory at Columbus. Blues 4, Ducks 2. Robert Thomas scored 2 power play goals in the third period, and St. Louis defeated visiting Anaheim for its 4th straight victory. Hurricanes 7, Senators 2. Dmitry Orlov recorded 2 goals and 2 assists, and Carolina scored 4 goals in the final period for a victory in Ottawa. And in another NHL story, Van Riemsdyk plays in 1,000th NHL game from Boston. On the night the Bruins celebrated him for playing the 1,000th game of his career, James Van Riemsdyk spent a moment remembering Game 1. It was October 2nd, 2009. He was 20, 7 months removed from playing at the University of New Hampshire and just over 2 years removed from being picked number 2 overall by the Flyers in the 2007 NHL draft. Philadelphia was opening its season in Raleigh, North Carolina against the Carolina Hurricanes, and Van Riemsdyk was in the lineup for the first time. "My parents missed it," said Van Riemsdyk, who couldn't remember why. "A few of my buddies that I grew up with in New Jersey drove down for that. It was a 3-1 win. I think I had an assist." He was almost right. The Flyers did win by 2 goals, but it was 2-0 behind a 28-save shutout by Ray Emery. Van Riemsdyk remembered the assist correctly. He got his first career point on the second goal of that game. Daniel Briere, who is now the general manager of the Flyers, was his teammate, and Rod Brind'Amour, who is now the coach of the Hurricanes, was still playing for them. "Crazy to think it was 15 years ago," said Van Riemsdyk, who will turn 35 in May. The Bruins had a pregame ceremony to honor Van Riemsdyk before Saturday's game. His parents, his wife, and his children joined him on the ice. He said there were 78 friends, family, former teammates, and coaches in the stands. After 8 years over 2 stints with the Flyers and 6 years with the Toronto Maple Leafs, Van Riemsdyk signed a 1-year deal for $1 million with the Bruins. He's been a bargain for Boston with 11 goals and 27 assists in 63 games. And the NHL stat of the day, 400. With a goal and an assist on Saturday, Coyotes forward Clayton Keller joined Shane Doan as the only players to reach 400 career points during the franchise's 28 years in Arizona. In one golf story from the Players Tournament, Scheffler repeat a TPC first. Doug Ferguson reports from Point Verde Beach, Florida. The roar could be heard from a half mile away just 16 minutes after the final group set out Sunday in the final round of the Players' Championship. It was loud enough to indicate something special had happened. The question was more what than who. Moments later, Scottie Scheffler's name appeared on the leaderboard, and he was on his way, adding another layer to his legend as the best in golf. His 8-under 64 tied the Players' Championship record for best Sunday score by a winner. His 5-shot comeback matched another tournament record, and he now stands alone as the only back-to-back champion in 50 years of the PGA Tour's premier championship. "It's tough enough to win one Players," said Scheffler, who was coming off a 5-shot victory last week at Bay Hill. "So to have it back-to-back is extremely special. Yeah, really thankful." For those trying to beat him, it was no surprise, even with Scheffler starting 5 shots behind. "Just another week," Xander Schauffele said when he saw that Scheffler had joined the chase. Wyndham Clark didn't see a leaderboard until number 11, and Scheffler was tied for the lead. "And I kind of chuckled and said, yeah, of course. I mean, he's the best player in the world," Clark said. Scheffler holed out for eagle from the fourth fairway. That was the enormous cheer, had 4 birdies in 5-hole stretch around the turn, and had so much control of his game that he played the final 31 holes on the scary TPC Sawgrass without a bogey. It added to a 1-shot victory that came down to the very last putt. Schauffele, Clark, and Brian Harman all had a chance to force a playoff with a birdie on the daunting 18th hole at the TPC Sawgrass. Clark had the last shot, a putt just inside 18 feet that dipped into the cup on the left side and came out on the right side, leaving him stunned as he placed his hand over his mouth. "I don't know how that putt doesn't go in," Clark said. "Even when it kind of lipped, I thought it would lip in. I'm pretty gutted it didn't go in." Schauffele missed an eagle putt from 25 feet on the par 5 16th and a birdie putt from 6 feet on the island green 17th. His approach from the pine straw on the 18th went long, and his chances were gone. Harman missed a birdie putt on the 18th from about 18 feet. They tied for second, and each earned just short of $1.9 million from the $25 million purse, the largest in golf. Scheffler finished at 20-under 268 and picked up $4.5 million for his 9th win worldwide, pushing him over $50 million for his career. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, March 18th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.